I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Girl, real talk. This whole "it's new year, time to reinvent myself" trash is not the vibe for 2024. You can find someone who loves you for you, as you are. You don't need to read a stack of self-help books, only eat sad salads, or like start meditating at 5 a.m. to be ready for dating. So yeah, my advice is to download Bumble and find someone who embraces you the way you are right now. Let me know how it goes.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Big box retailers, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a bill in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. Senate Bill 1838 would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, visit handsoffmyrewards.com and tell them to oppose credit card routing legislation paid for by the Electronic Payments Coalition.
Memoir writing is inherently risky. It is, you know, it is heart work and it is hard work. And it requires radical compassion and it requires, like a real commitment to interrogating memories and excavating memories. And so, you know, and when you add the racial element to it, you know, it can get very complicated and very messy. But what I knew for sure, and again, this comes with age, this comes with being the Black mother of a Black son, that, you know, I knew that my experience was the truth because I was the only one having it, you know?
I'm Jordan Kissner, author of the essay collection Thin Places, and this is Thresholds, a weekly series of conversations with writers and artists about moments of epiphany or transformation that changed their lives and their work. A moment that they stepped across, like a threshold, into something new, and the way that experience changed everything they wrote afterward.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Big box retailers, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a bill in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. Senate Bill 1838 would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, visit handsoffmyrewards.com and tell them to oppose credit card routing legislation paid for by the Electronic Payments Coalition.
If you live in New York, you might know Rebecca Carroll's voice from the radio. She's the host of Come Through with Rebecca Carroll with WNYC, where she was also a cultural critic and a producer. She's written a number of books about race in America, including the award-winning Sugar in the Raw, Voices of Young Black Girls in America. But we got together to speak about her memoir, which came out this year, called Surviving the White Gaze. It tells the story of how Rebecca grew up as a Black adoptee into a white family in a rural New Hampshire town. For years of her childhood, she writes, she'd never seen another Black person, except on television or in the movies. Her memoir tells the story of her relationship with her own racial identity, learning what it meant for her to be Black in her white family, in her community, in this country, and the decisions she faced about how she wanted to inhabit her own skin. It also crucially tells the story of her relationship with her birth mother, a white woman Rebecca finally met when she was 11, whose love and approval Rebecca craved, but whose behavior and ideas were often hurtful and laced with racism. Rebecca came on the show to talk about the conversation with her son that prompted her to write the book, her family's reactions to the memoir, and much more.
I always go back to the story that I've told before, which is the summer of 2014 when Michael Brown was shot in Ferguson, Missouri. And my son, who was then, let me do the math backwards, 9, asked if he was going to get shot because he's Black. And then he asked if I was going to get shot because I'm Black. And it was such a, it was both a turning point and a threshold. It's like all of this, I mean, this rage and this ferocity and this sense of protectiveness, it just bowled me over. It all happened at once. And I felt so angry that this had happened, but also that I had spent so much of my youth sort of, you know, struggling with and feeling gaslit and trying to define Blackness for myself while my parents, my white adoptive parents and my white adoptive siblings sort of blithely went about their lives. You know, obviously that's an overstatement. Everybody has their issues and concerns and traumas and difficulties. But regarding race, in that moment where my child was so astute, and I became a Black mother of a Black son, a Black woman in America, it just all sort of coalesced at the same time. So that definitely felt like a threshold. You know, it was deeply revelatory. And it was also, I mean, primarily because I knew that I couldn't go back to not feeling that way. And that was going to change the tenor and the dynamic between my white adoptive family. Not so much, you know, with my son or even my white husband, because we had all been sort of, you know, we had created our dynamic very much raising our son as a Black child. But it was a revelatory moment in that I knew I couldn't go back, right? I couldn't stop evolving. Like I couldn't put a pin in it. And it just sort of suddenly all of this reaction and excavation and you know, it all came out through writing. And I was a columnist at The Guardian at the time. And I just started, you know, writing these pieces one after the other that sort of touched on an experience that was, you know, that my son had really evoked and our dynamic and our togetherness and our reflection of each other and our closeness. And so, yeah, I immediately went to writing and to work through it and to keep the narrative growing, which is to say, I knew I was going to keep evolving, but I also knew that I had to keep sort of interrogating what that evolution meant.
Yeah. If you don't mind, I want to press a little further on that word evolution, which feels so lush. What was the specific evolution that you felt like you were being called to in that moment? Could you say a little more about that?
Yeah. I mean, I think that we all, and I mean, we as human beings, you know, we're here and we grow, right? That is the nature of the human arc. We're born, we grow, we die. But then there is something else that happens if we are willing and open to it. And that is that we evolve, that our ideas grow and change and push and broaden, that our sense of self, our sense of beauty, of integrity, it gets bigger and more encompassing. And so for me, that meant, you know, leaving sort of intellectually, physically, psychologically, this smaller space where I was raised and where my adoptive white family still lives, right? And so mm-hmm. I evolved out of that sort of bubble, but they did not. They continue to grow in that bubble, but there is no real sense of evolution.
The thing maybe that I'm driving at is that you had been doing that for mm-hmm. many, many years before 2014, before yep. that conversation with your son. And I guess I'm wondering when you felt like, okay, I have to keep evolving. Okay, I have to, there's an evolution that's now required of me after this conversation. What was was there something different about what you felt like was in front of you then?
Oh, my child. Oh, for sure. My son. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, there are many moments, some that are in the book and some that are not. I mean, particularly that moment where he sees a picture of him, of me on the wall and mm-hmm. thinks it's him. You know, it's like a visceral reaction to have been, you know, to have been adopted, to have not, to have experienced that primal severance, to not even, you know, is part of my DNA, that feeling of severance. And so to have my son not just reflect each other physically, but for him to somehow speak directly to the experience at 9 years old of what was going on in the climate, in the socio-political racial climate, when I was 9 years old, you know, all that I saw around me was whiteness. All that I saw around me, in retrospect, and in that moment that he made that point, I felt so sad for young me and angry for young me. And also like, it was like being, you know, in a fun house almost, you know, my reflection and my memory of that, of me at 9 years old suddenly felt like I was like being in a fun house. And there was this clarity of my child, of my flesh and blood that absolutely changed everything.
That phrase funhouse mirror is so awesome. I'm so glad that you just said it because it feels like it like names something about the achievement of this book that feels so immense, which is that I really felt when I was reading it, the funhouse mirror effect of mm-hmm. trying to look backward and capture with the benefit of future of your current experience and your current wisdom, the experiences of a younger you who was in many ways deprived of the information that you have now and that you were seeking then. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how do I want to put this? I'm wondering how you navigated that sort of toggling back and forth between what you know now, how you think of who you were as a young girl and a young woman, how you were trying to sort of re-access that state of mind from your current state of mind now. I ask because this is something that my students are like often ask me about and want to talk about. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's a hard thing to do, and it's so, so beautifully done in this book.
Thank you. I think that this goes back to the idea of evolution. And that is, and also, you know, you brought up the point of, you know, not really having any resources or the language that I have now, but I did have my instinct, right? Which is, you know, what I did not have is an instinct paired with the language to contextualize what I was experiencing. And so I have that now. And as I, in the process of writing this book, you know, I was thinking about being younger and some of the things that I did, you know, like using babysitting money to buy a birthday present for a boy that I liked, because that was, you know, that was a strategy. You know, I think one of the things at the time I was feeling, you know, like, this is so dumb. He's not going to like it. He's, you know, he doesn't like me. But in retrospect, I was like, that was some really smart strategy, right? Like to figure out a way to appeal or be relevant to these popular kids, particularly boys. And at you know, at the time, it would, you could have called it cunning, you could have called it manipulative, you could have called it, you know, social, you could call it a lot of things. But to me, to my current, you know, mind at this age and with wisdom, is that that was strategy, and it was instinct, and I was very much in survival mode. And so I, a lot of the time, and I think, you know, in terms of your students reflecting on experiences, you know, there is of course the idea of giving yourself grace, but there's also, you know, the idea of noticing, recognizing that you do what you have to do in a situation, or you don't go, you don't move, you stand still, you are stunted. And I just wasn't going to do that.
Yeah. It's funny when you were just saying, like, some people could call that manipulation or cunning. I was thinking, no, it just sounds like, it sounded like survival skills.
Yeah.
It sounded like the work of survival. Even if you wouldn't, even if sort of the younger Rebecca wouldn't have used those words to describe it, maybe. I'm curious how you amassed the sort of the store of memories that became this book, because it spans such a huge sort of length of time, and it also, like, does the very elegant work of wrestling with some things that feel fuzzily remembered, or that are remembered, you know, in your 20s or in your 30s, you know, that weren't always remembered but are now remembered. How did you find that material? Had you kept things in diaries? Were you sort of writing fresh?
Devout journal writer from the time that I was probably 10 years old. So I had, you know, hundreds of journals to reflect on. I also had lots and lots of letters. You know, my birth mother and I wrote letters back and forth constantly. My dad and I wrote letters to each other. My mom and I wrote letters. But it was journal writing, letters. And then I've always had a very particularly vivid sense of memory. Like, I have these insane dreams, and always have, that are really vivid, and I remember, you know, for years, you know, particular certain dreams. But I'm really glad you asked about, like, you know, grappling with the sort of fuzziness of things that, even if I had written it in my journal, it's like, is that so on and so forth. You know, you have to, again, you have to sort of decide, you know, memoir writing is inherently risky. It is, you know, it is heart work, and it is hard work. And it requires radical compassion, and it requires, you know, like, a real commitment to interrogating memories and excavating memories. And so, you know, and when you add the racial element to it, you know, it can get very complicated and very messy. But what I knew for sure, and again, this comes with age, this comes with being the Black mother of a Black son, that, you know, I knew that my experience was the truth, because I was the only one having it, you know? And, you know, there are a few things that, since the book came out, and, you know, my family has not taken it well at all. But they, you know, the things that they protest are very in character with the way in which they're written, which is, you know, sort of both interesting and depressing, right? Which is, they've all reacted in exactly the way I have written them and portrayed them would act. My dad is his major concern is not the racism that I experienced, not the inappropriate behavior from a family member, but that I didn't more effectively revere or articulate the uniqueness of their open marriage. You know, I mean, that, it, of course, that's what he's concerned about, because he has an enormous ego.
Did you trouble yourself with worrying about that? How it would how it would be received by your family as you were writing or during the publication?
So here, process? Here's the thing. And my therapist smartly said the other day, you know, the response to the book from your family is pretty much your next book. Because I wrote the book, the memoir, largely for them. I thought, this is an offering. This is an offering for you to understand and get a sense of what my experience was growing up a Black child in your/our family in an all-white town. Why wouldn't that be interesting to you? Why wouldn't you be able to receive that? Why wouldn't you want to? And that has not been the case. And so in terms of troubling myself about how they would respond, listen, I spoke at length with my sister about what she felt comfortable with me sharing in terms of her own trauma and experience. I asked everybody if I could use their names. I offered for my dad to read the manuscript before it went for copy edits, and he declined. I'd been in conversation with my mom constantly and sent her things that I've written. I mean, if any of the folks in my family had kept track of my career, I mean, most of the stuff that's in the book, not most, but much of which, and certainly the vein, has been explored in all of my writing throughout my career.
Right. It's not as if this is your first experience publishing on this subject.
Yeah. Right.
I'm interested to hear you say that it felt like the book was written for them as a way of trying to communicate your life experience to them, people who you were obviously so intimate with, but so separated from in different ways. Because it also reads, at least to me, one reader, as written very much for some version of your younger self or your child self. There's that moment where you're, is it June Jordan who says,
yes.
I just write for the girls who aren't here yet?
Yes.
Yes. It felt like a book like that too, where you were.
It was either June Jordan or Entezake Shange.
It was one of the, that's why I paused. I wasn't sure which one it was. And it read very much like a book that wasn't written for anyone, but the young person that you were, or the young person that might need the book.
So that's really a really important distinction. And I'm so glad that you brought that up. Of course, there's for someone and then there's for someone, right? So the book ultimately is for my son. It is also for young me and any version of young me. It is also for Toni Morrison. But in terms, when I say I wrote it for my white adoptive family, I mean that I wrote it thinking that this would be an offering of clarity, an offering as a family member, an offering of real vulnerability, and not, you know, for them in the same way that this is my legacy and I want my son to understand why it's so important that I say and do the things that I say and do. But you're right in that it is certainly for a younger version of me. It's for a bunch of folks in deeply different ways.
Did you talk with your son about the book while you were writing it and before it came out?
Yes. And also he has read it.
What was that like for you to have him read your book?
It was exciting. I was thrilled that he wanted to, because he's not a big reader on purpose, I'm sure. You know, and he's not the kind of kid who's going to be like real critical or really like want to talk a ton about it. And let's face it. I mean, it's a lot to absorb for anybody, but for certainly 15. I mean, he read it last summer. When did the book come out? This year? Yeah. So he read it earlier this year. And he did have one concern about my dad that we talked about. And I was really glad that he felt that he could come to me and say, this is really uncomfortable. And, I can understand that, you know, that your dad would be upset about it, but can we have a conversation? And so we did, you know, about boundaries and what that sort of whole issue of inappropriate behavior and this and that. So I was glad for him to bring that to me. And then he didn't tell me when he finished it. And so like a month or two ago, I was like, he said, I'm looking for something to read. And I said, did you finish my book? And he said, yeah, I finished it a long time ago. And I said, well, what did you think? And the only thing he said was, it was very good.
Oh.
I was like, all right, I'll take it. Yep.
That feels like a really important reviewer
to
get the thumbs up from.
Yep. You don't have to say anything else. I'll take it.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's so cool. Wanted to ask you about how you made decisions around portraying Tess, your birth mother, who you portray as someone who you loved and in many ways idolized, but who we as the readers start to be able to discern is maybe hurtful to you in all manner of ways, starting almost right away and in a sort of increasing way. When you sat down to work on this memoir, how did you wrestle with yourself about how you wanted to portray the arc of your relationship with her?
No, I didn't wrestle with it. In fact, it's one of the narrative threads in the book that I'm the most proud of, because there's a real clarity there that I didn't have, you know, and as we were talking about earlier, when I was a kid, you know, where it was just, why is this happening? Why is she saying this? What does this mean? What, you know, to be able to contextualize it and have clarity around that, and to also be able to portray the way in which I loved her so deeply, and how, you know, there was this unbelievable year of when we were just incredibly close, which, you know, was also unhealthy in its own way, but it was, you know, I look back at it very fondly. I'm proud to have been able to revisit that relationship and give it the arc of discovery, to myself. Right. And I feel like that was by far the hardest character. I don't know what you say when you're talking about people in memoirs, or one of the hardest people to write about. And that relationship was, you know, devastating and toxic and, you know, magnificent in very kind of life-changing ways. I mean, I would never, if you had told me when I was 20 years old that I would ever be at a place where I could see clearly the arc of that relationship and understand the ways in which it affected me at certain points in my life, I would have said no way. It was really like that kind of saturation in my mind and in my heart and in my life. And I've talked with girlfriends, you know, who have been with me for the whole ride. And it's been so interesting having them read it and sort of also see the clarity of that arc and the ways in which I used to emulate her and defend her. And and to have been able to fully extricate myself from that is an accomplishment that I'm proud of, and to have been able to write about it in a way that I thought, you know, I thought was compassionate as I could be. I feel good about that.
How did you take care of yourself during the writing process? Other people I've talked to who have written extensively about relationships that were tough found revisiting those relationships on the page tough. And I'm curious if that was the case for you, and if so, how you dealt with that.
I think the first draft was, you know, as with in most situations, was a struggle. And I, you know, I kind of dipped my toe in the water and thought, okay, I know what temperature it is, you know, let's swim for a little bit and then maybe not, you know what I mean? I wasn't like, is that really the temperature of the pool? Let me stick my toe in a little deeper. And I, you know, I was reluctant to really go as deep as I needed to go. I wasn't prepared for it to require an entirely new skill set. You know, writing a memoir is not like stitching together journal entries, which is, you know, something that I had to figure out and learn. But then when it started to flow, this is so cliche, I know, but it really was like such a joy. It was like such a relief. It, you know, the whole idea of catharsis was like, this is dope. This is like amazing, right? To feel like I was actually using a craft, my craft as a writer, to tell the story of my life was deeply thrilling to me. And I would say, in terms of the tough relationships, that was also like really like, okay, I am excavating this because it doesn't need to live in my body anymore. In fact, it's doing more harm in my body and in my brain. And I would very much say that about my relationship with Tess. Like, I don't think about that relationship anymore. It lives there. That's where it lives, in the memoir. And I, you know, I think I captured it as well as I could, and I'm glad for it to be out of my body and out of my mind.
When you were saying that it felt like having to develop an entirely different skill set, I think that was the word you used. Tell me more about that. What did you feel like you had to learn how to do to write this?
Write a memoir. You know, like,
yeah.
All of my previous books are at least in part interview based. And so I would, you know, and I worked as an editor for years, and I'm very into, you know, the podcasts I've done are conversational, and I've been a journalist. And so I know how to write essays and shorter pieces, but the idea of an actual, I mean, it is essentially a real, truthful novel. I mean, you have to make it read like people want to keep reading, right? It's not just this happened, and then this happened, and so on and so forth. There's a real, real craft to it. And I had never done that before.
Which parts felt especially challenging to you as you were shifting into that mode?
Staying on course and not digressing, you know, making sure that everything that was in the book spoke directly to surviving the white gaze. You know, I could have written an entire, you know, 5, 6, 7 chapters about my friendship with Leah, because that was such a profound relationship to me. But only the parts of my friendship with her that spoke to the white gaze and surviving the white gaze could make it into the book. And so that was really challenging, because there were, you know, my relationship with Catherine, my dad's lover, there was a lot around that I wanted to include that didn't have anything to do with surviving the white gaze.
Right. Right. The process of weeding out all these things that feel deeply important to the story of your life, but maybe are not relevant to the execution of this particular memoir.
Right.
And what, if I can ask on the other side, aside from the catharsis, what felt like especially joyful about entering this new mode?
I think, I just think intellectual freedom and clarity is so delicious, and that I have done this one thing well and right, and that I'm whole enough to be an you know, a good mother, a good partner, a good friend, a good person, you know, that surviving, it wasn't just about surviving, it was about becoming.
Becoming through the act of writing this book?
Becoming through the act of writing, and also just allowing those experiences to resonate and then let them go.
That's such a beautiful thing for a memoir to do. It feels like at its very best, that's what memoir can be for the writer and for the reader too.
I hope so.
Like, you know anything about your story, this story that you've told in this book, that you didn't know when you were at the beginning of the writing process or even in the middle of it?
Oh, that's a great question. At the beginning of it, I mean, I think it's probably full circle here, which, you know, going back to what we were talking about earlier, which is that I didn't know that I had so fully evolved out of my childhood, out of my all white surroundings, that there's really no turning back, that even my parents' love for me still exists in that bubble. And that in order for me to receive their love as I know it or knew it, I have to go back into that bubble. And I can't survive in that bubble. It's actually literally dangerous for me. And so I didn't realize that, that would be a result and or a revelation.
I think we're sort of getting close to time. Is there anything that you think that you want to return to, or that you think I should have asked you that I haven't yet asked you? Anything you wanted to speak to that we haven't touched on yet?
I mean, in very much on brand for me fashion, you know, I am curious to know if when you read it, like, there was immediately, like, the first question that came to mind for you.
Ooh, what a good question. The first thing that came to mind for me, the first question that came to mind for me. I think the first question that I had was the question that I asked you about writing about Tess, your birth mother, because from the very beginning, that relationship has so much tension in it and so much complexity to it and so much edge on it in terms of the way that she is portrayed, both with this this regard that feels loving but also highly critical. Like, I could just immediately feel the conflict that that this character was going to hold because of her behavior as it's described. And that was my first question, I think, of thinking, like, okay, I want to know how she made decisions. I want to know how Rebecca made decisions about writing this woman, who's a whole, you know, a whole complicated person, as you were saying. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, the portrayal obviously needs to be from your experience of her.
And so, you know, on going back to your question about the responses and how I said, you know, everybody has responded very much in the way that I portrayed them. My birth mother has emailed my publisher, my publicist, the head of business affairs at the Hollywood production company that optioned my book, an editor at a online magazine where I work, where I published rather, to try to eclipse my story.
Eclipse it?
Yes, which is that to use the opportunity of my story to amplify her own.
As in, sorry, I'm just want to make sure I'm understanding you. She's emailing or contacting everyone to say, I'm the real story. You should option my life, or you should buy my next book. Is that what you mean?
In effect, depending upon who she is reaching out to, the online publication, she said, you know, I'm the true story. I'm the real story. And to the production company, you know, she said, I wrote a book and Rebecca wouldn't allow for it to go into production. You know, all of the things that I wrote.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, it's interesting, even when I think about, you know, the way she spoke to me and dealt with race was obviously both problematic and racist. But at the time, you know, I didn't have any language for it. And I think particularly when she said something to me like, you know, how would you know what it feels like or what it means to be Black? I was like, yeah, you're right. You know, because I mean, her argument, she's saying you're completely socialized in a white environment. Your family is white. How would you know? But what she was saying was completely racist.
Yeah. There was something that I thought was that I really admired about the way you wrote scenes like that. And there were lots of them, in that you didn't supply yourself at that age, yourself in the scene. You didn't supply the scene with language that you have now, but didn't have then. We were just sort of
right
in the moment that you were in at whatever age that was, where we're reading along with these conversations, thinking, whoa, or uh-oh, or oh my gosh, or gosh, that's so hurtful, or geez, that's really racist. Mm-hmm. But the consciousness of the narrator at that time is like 9 and doesn't have those and that discrepancy and that tension also just was so interesting and exciting to me, and was one of the reasons why I wanted to ask you about her, about writing that relationship.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. It's interesting. I'm happy to think about it and talk with really smart people about it, because now it is sort of just interesting, you know, particularly given, you know, what I do in other projects and other writing and in this climate, you know, of racial reconciliation or whatever have you, but that I'm able to sort of look at that sort of foundational relationship, as an example of both what not to do, but also what to look for, right? And how to parent my own son and mentor folks. And so, yeah, I'm grateful.
Yeah. Another through line that felt so powerful in the book is kind of the flip side of the relationship with Tess, which is all of the relationships with Black people and especially Black women that kind of eventually, and, you know, in real life and in their writing, right? Like Toni Morrison or June Jordan, that begin to supply you with the language that you need and supply you with the frameworks and the language and the understanding and the wisdom and the, you know, all of that, that eventually allows you to, that brings you from the, I guess, 11-year-old to the person writing.
I mean, and that, as I said in the prologue, right, with my former student, I mean, that's what Blackness does. Like, Blackness finds us and we find each other, and there is this breadth of love and ancestral wisdom, and it's there to be embraced and shows up at the right time.
Threshold is a production of Lit Hub Radio. We're produced by Drew Broussard and Justin Alvarez. Music and editing by Laura Faye Oshwood of Arthur Moon. Our art is by Kirsten Huber. Special thanks to Farrar, Strauss, and Drew. I'm Jordan Kistner. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at jordan.kistner. We'll see you next week.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.